Okay, thanks very much. So it's a bit of an all legend on afternoon, although I'm going to tell you something a little bit more about the post legend on part of our pipeline and how we're doing processing as well. And you'll see some more of that on Thursday afternoon, oh no, Wednesday afternoon, I think, when Gabe and Neil present that. So I'm going to give just an overview of all of the automation we're doing, and some of it you will have seen from Joel, and then some of it you'll see in very practical terms from the whole group who's been developing this this afternoon and in 2 days' time. So all of these efforts at automation are sponsored by NCRR, in which we run the National Resource for Automated Molecular Microscopy. And as I mentioned in my introduction, we established this resource 5 years ago with the goal of developing, testing, and applying technology aimed towards automating and streamlining cryo-electron microscopy. So what are the goals? That's the mission, but what are the goals of automation? Well, there's many of them, and I hope I'll illustrate the various aspects of that in the next 40 minutes of this talk. I mean, one of which is just to simply facilitate the process. You shouldn't have to necessarily spend 2 years and going to courses like this and training and months of effort in order to get a 3D structure if you have a nice protein or a nice structure to want to look at. And in the very early stages of setting up the resource, we had someone come to us with a little, what they thought was a nice little DNA cage, but of course they'd never seen it. They just had theorized that this would form a cage, but nobody would believe them. So within a few weeks of arriving, you know, we had the data collected. A month or so later, it was analyzed, and then, you know, a month later, it was on the front cover of Nature. We wish it was always that easy, but those are the sorts of people we do want to be able to have access to this technology, not someone who spent 2 years of their life learning it and then finally got the structure, just someone who wants an answer. But that's not all we want to do. We want to increase the throughput. We heard from Nico this morning that he used, 3 million particles, if you like, for his reconstruction. Well, if we're going to use 3 million particles of anything, we're going to have, I think, a very high degree of automation. We're going to have a very high throughput. We want to optimize the resolution. Again, you saw from Nico, you can play all these kinds of games. Let's select the good particles from the bad particles. Let's look at the defocus. Let's look at the drift. Let's look at where it came from on the grid, all those kinds of things. Those sorts of things are handled much better if you automate the process and you have it controlled very tightly by a database, as I hope I'll show you. One of the things we'd like to do is expand the possibilities of things we'd like to try. Ron gave us some advice the other night saying it's ridiculous to try this whole cubic ice idea. Why would you do that? It's an 8-hour experiment for us to try it because we have a high level of automation. We can toss in a virus, we can heat the thing up, and we can reconstruct it. Ron's probably right, it won't work, but why not try it? Whereas if you had to spend 3 weeks, you know, shooting films and developing them and hand-picking the particles and going through the process, why would you bother? It's obviously too much work. So we do sort of feel that this level of automation allows you to try quick and dirty things and try them out. And then we want to open the technology to a wider audience. We've done quite a lot of work with Merck on their Gardasil vaccine when they were characterizing it prior to it being released with FDA approval. So these kinds of people, the big pharmaceuticals, want a very high level of automation and control. They do not want to throw their protein into a lab where they're not quite sure what's happening into it and exactly what process it's going through. So for all of those reasons, we feel that automation is a worthwhile goal. So this is the process we have, right? We have a protein. We need to freeze it, get it onto a grid. We need to image the right areas. We need to pick particles. We need to do a bunch of processing and a bunch of refinement. So in our view, that's a pipeline. Just as the X-ray crystallographers set out to streamline this pipeline for X-ray crystallography many, many years ago, and very seriously 5 or so years ago, we're trying to think of the process as a pipeline ourselves. And it's a pipeline with bottlenecks, and it's a pipeline with leaks. And all we do is face the current bottleneck or the current leak. We don't try and automate every single thing for the sake of automation. We do the things where we're really held up and where things are really bothering us. So that has been the philosophy in setting all this up. And as you heard from Joel the other day, the very first step in everything is to make the grids themselves. And we now, with our plasma cleaner and our Vitrobot, we're having a lot more success than we had before. That's not to say we couldn't make a grid before, But when you've got 20 or 30 projects rolling through this resource a year, and people come from maybe, you know, Europe or England for the 3 days of data collection, you better not be spending 3 days trying to find the right grid for them to make. That's fine if it's your project and you're spending the next 2 years on it. It's not fine when they come in and they need the data and they need to get right back out. So Debbie was saying earlier, she cleans her quantifoils in whatever it was, you know, toxic chemical number one. And then she, when it's not working, when it doesn't work, she'll bake them. And that sort of freezes my heart. You know, when somebody's come from England and you find out it's not working and maybe we'll try baking it, that's not what you want to do. What you want to know is it's going to work because that's the way it always works. So that's why we're trying to achieve this sort of more reproducibility than may be necessary for most of the people in this group. So where was I going with that? Okay, so as Joel told you, so the VitroBot's very straightforward, right? It's a recipe, you dial it up, you say, you know, what range of times you want, et cetera, et cetera. The one thing that was bothering us was the ethane. So new people to the job would sometimes let the ethane be too warm, they'd sometimes let it freeze solid and smash their grid. So that was the one bit that wasn't automated, and it was a bottleneck because we were losing grids. So Denis built this nice little feedback heater that we can keep the ethane now at the right temperature. Denis's very unhappy with this graph because it varies by 3 or 4 degrees, and he knows he can get it to vary by less than a tenth of a degree, but it's not necessary. That's not a bottleneck. So we don't build that new device, even though it would be straightforward to do. I heard somebody say earlier, I think it was Linda Melanson, that they now have some evidence that keeping your ethane warmer gives better grids, and this is something we can easily try. We'll just set this thermostat to keep the ethane at exactly that temperature, and we'll just run an experiment and see how that works. So with these techniques in specimen preparation, we can take an undergraduate and train them how to make grids in a day or so. You know, they have to have good hands and they have to follow instructions, but they don't have to have that magic, you know, sit in the cold room, when does the filter paper just separate, and, you know, they get it wrong the first 3 months of their lives and then go and do X-ray crystallography. Most of the time. So the other question we were asked is, why do we use these C-flat grids? Well, for two reasons, the one of which I already mentioned. You know, this, you know, putting it in chloroform and baking it out and trying to get rid of the background was driving us crazy, because some of the time it worked, but not all the time. The other thing that was driving us crazy was the yield of specimen from each hole. We were looking at these over quantifoil holes, and you'll see that all the particles are confined to the edge of the hole. You can see that a little bit better on this magnified image. This does not happen with big particles. It doesn't happen with icosahedral viruses, because the lip at the end of the hole, which is causing this concave meniscus, is, you know, that lip and the thickness of the ice are well matched to the virus, and the viruses are across the hole. But go to something like GroEL or something smaller, and it all gets jammed up against the edge of the hole. So we're trying for high throughput, right? We shoot about 1,000 of these images a day, and most of the particles are jammed up here. Most of the image is blank, and we can't pick these because they're too crowded anyway. So this was incredibly frustrating. And that's what drove Joel, because now this became a bottleneck. We weren't getting a high enough throughput. That led Joel to think about using some other methods for making grids. And these are, we used to call them jacks in our lab. I think Joel's amazing holy carbons or something. But now they're commercially manufactured as C-flats from protochips. And the idea is to use a silicon template, use the methods Ken Downing, I think, came up with VictorWet, as a releasing agent, and you evaporate the carbon on, you release the carbon, and then you get these beautifully smooth, very, very clean carbons. And now it's carbon. It's not this plastic garbage that you have to take off. We understand much better the hydrophilic, hydrophobic nature of that substrate because we know it's carbon and it's not a million other things that have been treated. The other huge advantage to us was now we get a much better distribution of particles across the hole. If we look here, now there's GroEL spread right across the hole. You can see it a little bit better. There's GroEL in all areas of this grid, and the distribution is much better. So we went from being able to get 100,000 particles of GroEL in a run to 300,000 particles of GroEL in a run. Sorry. Well, that's a bottleneck right there. You're right. So this improved our throughput a lot. And that, so that's specimen preparation. So at every aspect of this, you know, you need to worry about automation, you need to worry about throughput so that you can reproduce it and you can give it into the hands of people who don't want to spend their lifetime becoming experts. Which isn't to say I don't think that the people who spend their lifetime becoming experts don't get better results. I mean, we are going to try and get the best results we can. Clearly, if you spend 3 years going after something, you're going to get better. But we will catch up to that point eventually. So that's what we're aiming for. So once you have your specimen, we have an automated data acquisition system, which is called Legenon. You might have heard mentioned a few times. And basically what it is a system for multi-scale imaging. Just as a microscopist sits in front of a microscope and they look at the image at one meg and they make a decision, hey, that looks like an interesting area. Yeah, that might be a square I'd kind of like. That hole might be a hole one could go after. I'm going to go and focus over here and check the drift, and then I'm going to take the high mag image. That's what Legenon does, except it has all automated software and vision and various computational aspects that are making those decisions as it goes along. And Jim and Denis will give you a demonstration of that software in the next half hour or so. And it's actually running in the control room at the moment. You'll see it's collecting data. You'll see some of that. Oh, I just wanted to mention, at the very beginning of doing this, we did it in a very brute force way. We thought, well, we'll just find every square and find every hole, and we'll go to every hole and take pictures of it. That sort of brute force doesn't work at all. The size of a grid compared to the size of a protein is about the size of a person in Southern California. There's a lot of people in Southern California. But unfortunately, the good beaches are only around about here and there. And we need the people on the good beaches, not in the desert and not in the deep ocean, if you want to think of that, it's thick ice and thin ice. So you have to develop these intelligence systems, and it's hard. Replacing a human being at a microscope is a really tough job. People are really, really good at pattern matching, really good at making decisions. They're not really good at sitting there and doing the same thing for 72 hours, however, and Legenon is extremely good at doing that. Okay, so you'll hear more about how we acquire the images. Once you have the image acquired, you have to pick the particles, and you go and you pick one, and you pick another one, and you pick another one, you pick another one, and then you pick 10,000, and then you start thinking about that X-ray crystallography life again. And I think you can pick 10,000 particles. I think you might pick 50,000 particles, 100,000 particles for that project you passionately care about, for that one-off thing. But to do it again and again for every mutant state, for every conformational state, to do it the million times or the 6 million times that Nico is indicating, it's insane. Okay, we have to automate this step. And we will probably never do it as well as people in a good case. We sometimes might do it better, though, by an automated system because we're not as biased, okay? People will pick something like this all the time, and if it's like that, they might miss it, okay? An algorithm is not as biased and might pick up things like that. So we have to judge which one is better. I actually think this is still an unsolved problem. There's plenty of particle pickers out there. They don't all work all of the time. The system we used is based on Alan Roseman's algorithm and also some method that we use for sort of knocking out the big chunks of ice and things like that. But it's essentially a cross-correlation method. For something like GROEL, it's about 95% accurate if you give it a few decent templates. It's really, really, really good. For something much smaller, it's a little tougher. And I think this is an unsolved problem that we need to get at. I think it's an unsolved problem that for people to pick these kind of small particles, too. I mean, I've seen people picking some small particles and think, okay, if that's what you say. So I think we need sort of less bias in the whole system. Because we feel we need better particle pickers, Craig in our lab has been working on a new algorithm based on difference of Gaussians, and I think he might talk a little bit about that on Thursday. That is a very unbiased particle picker. It just picks every blob in the image, and based on a certain size and criteria. And that's more or less what people are doing with an unknown particle. They're picking blobs, and this is great for getting going on a new system. If you want some templates to pick with, this difference of Gaussians picker will pick you a bunch of stuff. You can classify those, pick a couple of classes to then use as template pickers. So it gets you booted up. And get you booted up with not as much bias as if you go hunting down those templates that you want, because then you might miss all the other views. The other thing that Dog Picker is really good at is discriminating size. if you have a virus that's in a couple of different sizes and it's decorated with an antibody, these template pickers are really bad at discriminating those out. It's kind of hard to do it by eye, too. But this dog picker did very well on that kind of problem. Okay, so assuming you got all your particles picked out, of course you have to correct the CTF, as you've heard lots about. We have our own automated CTF correction system called ACE. Why did we go and do yet another one when there were lots out there? Our problem was all of the ones out there, which were really, really good in lots of packages, were not automated enough. We wanted something that we would never have to touch. We didn't want to have to pick what the background is, pick where the min and max was, any of that. We couldn't afford that because we're collecting something like 1,000, a couple of thousand images in a run. And, you know, once ACE wasn't working, I said, oh, we'll just do it by hand. You know, after the first 10, it's like, okay, let's go and fix ACE. Because, I mean, it's really tedious to do it. And again, if you're on film and you have 50 films, fine, go do it 50 times. 1,000 times, it's just brutal. I mean, you know, nobody wants to sit and do the same thing 1,000 times in a row, certainly not every day of the week. So it's critical that this sort of thing be automated. So what ACE does is do probably very similar to Nico's algorithm, and it finally does a fit between the CTF it finds and the data. And the best thing is it comes up with a fitness factor, a confidence value as to how well it thinks it fitted the data. It actually comes up with two of these confidence values. And we know from looking at the fits that if we say we only want images where the fitness factor was greater than 8, we are 100% of the time getting a good fit. So it doesn't work 100% of the time. It works something like, Scott will tell me, 90% of the time, or maybe a little better. But we throw away those 10%. Rather than go through 1,000 images, you know, checking to see if it worked or not, we just say, fine, okay, now we've only got 900 images, it's still plenty, and it saved us a whole day of checking. So all of these automation algorithms, I think it's essential to have not the perfect performance that a person does, but to have methods of evaluating the performance and knowing it's good enough. So that's really what we're building in a lot of the time. When we first started doing Legend on, you know, we'd have the thing, you know, there's a square and it would pick some holes and somebody said, why doesn't it pick that hole? You know, I would have picked that hole. Why doesn't Legendon pick that hole? We have no idea. We'll just find another one on another square. You know, there's, you know, I don't know, 400,000 holes on a grid. Who cares if it doesn't pick the one? It only matters if you can't figure out a bad one that it's picked and you can't throw it out later. So we're sort of trying to optimize things in that way. Okay. So once you have all the particles picked, it's all correct, you've got your CTF corrected images, you select particles out of them, and then you do some refinement and classification, as you've heard about, and you come up with a final 3D model. So that's the pipeline we've been trying to build. We've been putting these pieces together and trying to make that as smooth as possible. I actually was trying to redo this slide with glass pipes to make the point that this is not a black box. In our vision, this automation makes the process more transparent, not less transparent. I think when people are typing little numbers here and little numbers there and rummaging all over the disk for these files and trying to put them together, they get so distracted by the process, they sometimes don't look at the results too carefully. So what the automation is designed to do is throw these results back out at you and make you look at them and make you evaluate them and especially make you evaluate them across different conditions and across different runs. And so that's the pipeline we've been building. This is what it actually looks like, and Gabe will demonstrate this on Wednesday. It's a series of steps, you know, particle selection, CTF estimation, assessing the micrographs, some things for finding the garbage and throwing them out, making stacks, doing reference reclassification, reference-based classification, doing the reconstructions. In all of this, you need templates and initial models so you can get to upload them. And all of this is tracked by a relational database. You can see it takes the entire village to automate cryomicroscopy. So all the people in the lab at the moment are working on this project and contributing to this process. You can use a bunch of different algorithms. You know, for particle picking, you can use template picking, dog picking. You can manually edit picks if you like. And all of these are being tracked by this database and therefore can be compared in a very standard way. What we hope to add in here is FreeAlign. And then, as Nico was saying, he got a different result with Spider versus FreeAlign. It would be great to do everything else exactly the same and then compare those two at the end, and then we can say, it really does make a difference. Or maybe it was some earlier processing step or something like that. So what this allows you to do is keep very tight control of everything you do as you go through the process. So this, Gabe will show more of this. What the pipeline does is allow you a web-based entry for all the parameters involved in you know, your particle picking or your reference realignment or whatever. And it tries to do that in a standard way so that you're doing everything in a very repeatable way. And, of course, it's keeping track of all the parameters you use so you can go back to them at any time. It doesn't do this in a black box again. It does this in a script, and you can go and edit that script. You can take control of it. You can do anything you like to it. You can modify it. You can do whatever. It's not trying to hide that away from you. It's just trying to standardize it, keep track of it, and make it a little easier for somebody who's starting out, or for someone like me who does it every 3 months and can never remember what they're doing when they go back to it 3 months later. The results of all that picking, as I say, are very transparent. They all get sent back to the database and then can be looked at in different ways. So you'll see in a minute when Denise shows you the database, we can now go look at our high mag images. We can see the picks we did for a particular template pick, say. We can look at the Fourier transform of the focus image that we used to get it. We can look at the ACE fit, and then we can decide whether to reject that image or not. We can reject it on all kinds of ways, or we can reject it based on fitness factors. So all of this information that we put into this pipeline is now available for viewing by the user. We can go and look at things, we can compare things, we can evaluate which method we prefer. Other results like the reconstructions come out in similar ways on big web pages where you can get at the classes, you can get at the FSCs, you can get at the Eulers, you can look at your good particles versus your bad particles and see, well, is there any difference? You could classify them, and you can do all of these kinds of things in a standard way and then compare this against runs, compare this many months later, or you know, when you've changed something about your sample prep, et cetera, et cetera. These are all maps we produce with this pipeline. That's great. We can, you know, shovel something in, and we can generally do this, you know, for a well-understood system in a few days or a week. But the thing that I've just whipped through is, what about the initial model? I happen to think that is like the most critical thing we have to solve, certainly in our lab. I mean, we can do all this for an icosahedral virus, no problem. You know, it's got enough symmetry. We can figure it out. For something like GROEL, we know what it looks like to start with. But for a very small thing, a 300 kilodalton thing that you're starting with, I think it's a really, really challenging problem to get this reconstruction done. And the reason is we don't know what it looks like to start with. So the initial model problem is very important. You know, so all of this is fine, but you know, a small miracle occurred here, and we tossed in this initial model. So that's the real thing I think we need to go after. And there's lots of people working on this. You know, people are using fairly advanced theoretical approaches. I know Joachim Frank's lab is doing that. I know Ava Nogales' lab is doing that to try and sort of get that initial model ab initio from the individual frames. We've taken a very practical experimental approach, and we're going to try and get it through either random conical reconstruction, orthogonal tilt reconstruction, or tomography. And so all of those are things we've been trying to automate as well. You'll hear later in the afternoon a little bit more about these orthogonal tilt reconstructions and random conical tilt reconstruction methods. You know, the difficulty, I think random conical tilt is such a great method, and it should be more used, but it's a miserable method to use, right? You're taking images, then you've got to tilt, you've got to take some more, and if it's in ice, it's all drifting around, and it's, you know, making you crazy. And, you know, picking targets from a 0 degree to a 60 degrees, this looks real easy because there's lots of holes. Even so, you know, there's big pieces of crud coming in, and it's very confusing. It's really hard to do that in the long run for a long period of time. So this really needs to be automated, and that's what we've done. Craig will tell you about that. So we can get, you know, for something like imaging in stained grids over carbon, 370 tilt pairs in 8 hours. That's about a pair every 2 minutes. That's not much slower than we can get when we're not tilting. So, you know, that's fairly fast, and it means in a decent run, you're going to get enough particles to do a massive random conical reconstruction, even if you've got things like conformational variability, etc. We're looking for, you know, tens of thousands of particles in these runs, not just a few hundred. So that's why we need these kinds of throughput. Better than that, we really want to do, this just shows you, you know, there's good overlap. I mean, it's no good having these pairs if they're not overlapping. So there's good overlap between the particles. Better than that, we want to do this in ice. And in ice is really challenging because the thing drifts and misbehaves. And you've also been hearing it charges like crazy. We have preliminary data, as Joel talked about, on these cryo-mesh grids from prototypes that we don't see charging. We don't know if we were just lucky that day. We certainly see charging on carbon grids, so we couldn't have been just luck. But it's very preliminary. We've only done this a couple of times, so we wouldn't want to bet the farm on this, but it does seem very promising. And this is extremely going to be extremely useful for Andrei Lechsteiner's method, the orthogonal tilt reconstruction method, because there you need two tilt pairs. And now, you know, if charging hits you 50% of the time on a tilt, and now you have two tilt pairs, you might be fresh out of luck unless you can solve this charging problem. So we're very encouraged by that. And again, the data collection rate is, again, about a pair every 2 minutes. So in an eight-hour run, you know, we can collect many, many, many particles and really get a hope for doing some sort of statistical sorting of them and do some initial model calculation. David mentioned, I think in his talk, that one method of getting an initial model might simply be to do tomography. So tomography is another thing that is built into Legenon. The system is very modular, so instead of saying collect just an image at a target, you can say get me a tilt series at the target. And so, you know, our vision was that when we're collecting a run, we might just get a tilt series every 50th image acquisition. Why not just get a whole tilt series? Then we could go and sort out later, and we could analyze things like where the particles were in the ice, and we could get that sort of extra information, because if it's really straightforward to do this and you know, isn't a lot more effort. This is actually not a project we did in our lab. It's a project done in Grant Jensen and David Agard's lab by Christian Salloway and Sean Zheng. So we're using basically Agard's algorithm inserted into Legenon to basically automate the tomographic acquisition. One nice thing about doing it in Legenon is you get all this extra data. You know, the database is tracking where the grid is and where the z-axis is and blah, 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 blah. So you can look at it later and figure out if your goniometer is behaving. You can reject tomograms that where, you know, things went bad and you don't have to bother analyzing them and finding out the hard way that things went wrong. And you can call up the microscope company and complain if your goniometer is not behaving. So you get this extra information. Okay, so in the last few minutes, I'll just tell you a few results. So these were our goals. You know, how does it do all this? So facilitating the process, here's an example of a project where we've done, I don't know, 50 reconstructions. Gabe might be able to tell you, endless number of reconstructions. This is a group who want to use virus particles as platforms for display. They want to develop chemistry so they can attach things to virus particles. They can attach, you know, strange amino acids or various kinds of attachments. So they want to bring in their sample. They want to know that day, did this work or not? Because if it didn't, they want to go back and do some chemistry. They don't want to spend 3 months figuring out if it worked. So they come in. You know, it takes about an hour to prepare the grid. We stick it in Legenon, get it set up, get it all settled down. We collect data typically for 12 hours on a project like this. At the same time as the data is being collected, you can pick the particles. You can do the CTF correction. As soon as that's finished, you can submit this to a cluster for reconstruction. In about 5 hours, you can end up with a reconstruction at about sub-nanometer. So in a day, you should be able to get a sub-nanometer reconstruction, and then you might go for several years. You know, that's up to you. And we know it's sub-nanometer because we can see alpha helices. And this whole issue resolution determination, I think, should really be much more based on what you can see in the image than anything else. And so what we see here on this hepatitis B virus is these four little alpha helices sticking out of the surface. So we know it's sub-nanometer. And that's what they want to see, because they could then see, you know, a lump or a bump of that sort of 10-nanometer size thing, and that's what they're looking for. So this is good enough. This facilitates the process. It lets, you know, somebody with very little training in a chemistry lab come in, just bang through these things, and get the result that they need. In terms of throughput, a nice example is from Gabe Lander, who was looking at the structure of bacteriophage P22. And like Wah's group did, he wanted to get the asymmetric reconstruction because he's really interested in this tail machinery. That's where, you know, all the action is happening, where the DNA pump is doing its bit. So he needed to do this as an asymmetric reconstruction. And they are big particles. And we did it at high magnification, so there's not many per frame. So For the 5,000 images he needed, for the 25,000 particles he needed, he collected 5,000 images. And I think these were done in one or a couple of very, very heroic runs, several of which took 72 hours, you know, to complete. Gabe basically lived at the lab and just collected images. But it was done in a short period of time. I mean, 5,000 images is quite a lot, you know, if you had to do it by hand. We will discuss the whole film CCD thing in a bit. So that's the reconstruction. You know, told him a lot about this beautiful machinery. They were able to hypothesize about how this sort of mechanical pressure-sensitive device, you know, was able to transfer the information about how crowded the head was with DNA to the outer machinery. And Gabe can tell you all about that if you want to hear more about it. You know, again, I mean, it's really important to have a high level of automation because they don't want to do this once. They now want to do it for a whole bunch of mutant studies, for a whole bunch of different states. And, I mean, if it had taken 2 years to do, you know, your enthusiasm for doing it 5 more times might be quite diminished. Whereas if it only takes a few weeks to do, well, why not? You know, why not do it for, you know, the 3 or 4 mutants that your collaborators are pushing on you? So it's a real challenge for automation. A lot of people have asked us over the years, but doesn't contamination do you in? You know, you're running for 72 hours, your grid contaminates, you're not going to get anywhere. And she did a series of contamination studies lasting over, you know, 40 hours at a stretch, and she did many, many of these, and basically just measured, she had a holy carbon with some carbon over some of it, and you can see how, you know, over time, there's contamination building up on the carbon versus here, so you get to calibrate, you know, what's non-contaminated versus contaminated. And using that method, she measured contamination rates. Without film in your microscope and with an anti-contaminator in, I think the rate of contamination is, what, 10 nanometers? Okay, is that what it is? 10 nanometers an hour or something like that. So over 24 hours, you know, you build up some tens of nanometers, but not thousands of nanometers. So you can keep going a fair amount of time if you keep your microscope spotlessly clean. Add film to the system and you're dead within, you know, 8 to 12 hours. You keep exchanging that film box and you're just adding so much water and you're adding so much garbage into the column that you don't last too long. And of course, without the anti-contaminator, which Nigel has told us many, many, many years ago, you really are in trouble. But we were doing this just as a sort of a standard to make sure we were comparing the right things. So we don't think contamination is a massive problem over these long runs. Finally, I just want to say a little bit about using these automation methods to sort of face some of the problems similar to what Nico was talking about this morning. We use GrowEL for that purpose. We can collect in a single run, you know, 300,000 particles at a magnification of, say, 50,000 if we're at about 2 angstroms a pixel. GrowEL has a high degree of symmetry, a 14-fold symmetry, so you can start dividing these particles into small subsets and comparing them, and we can start to do various comparisons, and that's what we've started doing. And this is all predicated on the fact that every single thing about these images is in the database somewhere, where they came from on the grid, you know, what the ice thickness was, what time of day they were collected, you know, who was in the room at the time. He actually did set that up, but I don't think that's working at the moment. So one of the things Scott did immediately was to compare ice thickness. So because we have... you stop. I think I have 5 minutes. Yeah. Because we have 300,000 particles or so, we can divide them into 10,000 particle bins based on their ice thickness and still sorted with a nice even distribution of defocus values. And 10,000 particles times 14 gives us 100,000 asymmetric subunits, and sort of the rule of thumb in the field is that with 100,000 subunits, you should be able to get to sub-nanometer. And we were only interested in looking at these sort of sub-nanometer issues. So what he found was that thinner ice gives you better resolution than thicker ice, but boy, not only the resolution, it gives you a much better particle. So it's not just the resolution we're basing this on, but the appearance of the 3D reconstruction. There's not much difference between this ice thickness. It's probably a factor of 2. We figure this thin ice is just bigger than a GrowEL particle, and the thick ice over here was about twice the GrowEL particle. Actually, I think hard to see that by eye. If you're making these ice thickness decisions by eye, it's kind of tough to make those kinds of subtle decisions. But if you're using an automated system and basing it on an intensity value, you can be quite picky about the thickness of your ice. So that was one of the things Scott did. We, of course, also looked at how our resolution varied by number of particles. With about, I don't know, is this 10,000 particles, we get just less than sub-nanometer resolution. With 150,000 particles, we're getting 7.8. This is certainly much better than this, but, man, we're paying a price for it here. And this is the difference between CCD and film, right? We are really paying for the MTF of the CCD camera here. So one way you can get around that is just up your mag. So we can reduce our pixel size or bin or whatever, however you want to put it. When you up your mag, though, you reduce that pixel size, you're really cutting down the number of particles. You know, instead of 500 particles per image, now we're less than 100 particles an image. So, you know, it's a balance. It depends what resolution you're going after. But certainly, with these higher mag and therefore better improved MTF of the camera, we now can, with 50,000 particles, get something like 5.5 angstrom resolution, if you want to believe the FSC. But more than that, if you want to see that you've got a slight handedness on some of the alpha helices, so we know we're sort of approaching 5 angstrom resolution. So CCDs are not great, and they do have some disadvantages, but we can get to 5 or 6 angstroms resolution on them in a day's worth of data acquisition. So that's not too bad. And when those good cameras, the Medipixels or whatever the other devices are that Richard was talking about, come along, we'll be so ready, okay, to go to 3 angstroms with this level of automation. Scott and Gabe and several other people in the lab want to take the mag up to 200,000x and do the thing again and to see where this curve ends up. I mean, it's interesting to note that we're still going down here. You know, we're at 5.7 at 50,000. So, have we tapped out or will we keep going down? And how many more particles do we need to add in order to go to the higher resolution? So those are the kinds of experiments we've been doing with the database and the automation. You know, we've compared the resolution with number of particles for higher mag, 1 angstrom per pixel versus 2 angstroms a pixel to compare the camera capability. We've looked at KeV differences. We've compared 80 KeV, 120 KeV, 200 KeV to see what kinds of differences those make. You know, there's a real, for CCD cameras, you can up your KeV, you worsen the performance of your camera, whereas maybe if you up your KeV, you get better resolution. So where's the sweet spot is what we're trying to find out. You know, if you want a resolution of 6 angstroms, where should you be working? We're not, maybe one day we'll be able to say if you want a resolution of 3 angstroms, where should you be working? But right now we're saying these automated methods, the CCD, can give you a map of 5 to 6 angstroms if your data can sustain that. We've also looked at dose. Across KeV, across systems and specimens. But this is where we know we have to do a much more careful job. You know, something as simple as saying, oh, let's change the dose and see what works out. But if you change your dose, you change your spot size or you change your intensity, which means you've changed the coherence of your beam. Or you've changed the length of exposure, which means you've changed the drift rate. So all of these things are back chatting to each other and interacting in a very complicated way. And I think what we want to do over the next year is develop a much more robust model for what is going on with all of these factors, some of the important factors taken into account, so that when we trap one, we know we're controlling the others in a very exact way. And working on that, we hope to come up with some kind of a model for if you want 10 angstrom data and your particle is 200 megadalton, these are the conditions you should be using to acquire it. This is the dose, this is the KeV, this is the mag, and this is, the conditions on your scope. And I don't think there's any reason why we shouldn't be able to do that if we can model it well enough. And I think that's it. So you saw the pictures of people all along the way. This is the entire group, all of whom are working on a lot of this. Jim has been the principal architect of Legionon with a lot of help from Denis and Angie, and has been working on that project for many years. Denis has written all the database infrastructure. You'll hear him talk about that in a minute. And he's also our device builder, built the ethane heater, some of the robotic technology. Joel developed the C-flat new grid substrates and has developed a lot of the technology involved with making the grids, and is also our best Legendon user. He makes Legendon work better than anyone else, I think. And she is a scientist really driving this technology and making sure that it ends up useful for scientists as opposed to some really beautiful piece of software, you know, that we think is very elegant. Teddy is a tech who helps Joel and who's set up Legendon this morning. Gabe is our graduate student who can run longer than anybody else in the world on a microscope continually and did the beautiful work on P22 and is really helping write the pipeline at the moment. Craig wrote Dog Picker and did all the efforts towards random conical and orthogonal tilt reconstruction. Pickway is a brand new graduate student who's already jumped in and is helping writing the pipeline. And he really needs a lot of this because he's working on a very tiny little particle. So he's going to need every little bit of technology we can develop. Anka is also a new graduate student who's also already helping write this pipeline and did some of the reference-based classification methods. Sunita works on the ACE, the CTF reconstruction, has just put astigmatic correction in there. Neil's a new postdoc. He's been working on random conical reconstruction and helping a lot with the pipeline. Christopher runs all the systems and has just installed a cluster. Lorraine, you all know, is our administrator, and me and Clint. And Scott, who used to be a postdoc, but I'm putting him in here honorary because he's had so much to do with a lot of this work over the last few years, and he's now an assistant professor in Florida. Thanks for your attention. I'm just going to leave this playing. This is the robot. David said this robot should be bringing me coffee, and I'm sad to say it's never once made me a cup of coffee or offered me a bottle of champagne. This is sort of a little bit outside the scope of what this workshop's about, but if anybody's interested in learning about these robotic technologies, we can talk a little bit about them too. This is a robot that loads negative stain grids, not cryo grids, and you know, it can basically run through 100 grids in a weekend, get them loaded into the scope, imaged, and you know, offloaded. And these are for these sort of screening applications or serial section applications, that sort of thing. The first time you watch that robot approach your microscope like that is very heart-stopping. You know. It's big, and your microscope's delicate. You know. But in fact, our engineers like that robot. They think it's better than people, because once it's trained, it never, you know, grinds the specimen holder right down the edge of the tube, and it doesn't tear things apart because it pulls too hard or anything like that. So it's pretty well-behaved. So thank you for your attention. I'm happy to take a few questions, but you probably should address them to the people who are going to show you the applications more than me. Thanks.
Questions or comments?
Bob.
I'm not sure I heard you correctly. The ice contamination rate in the case of no film and the other contaminators, is that 1 nanometer per hour?
No, 1 angstrom per hour. One angstrom per hour. Sorry, yeah. I was flustered saying that. I thought, I've forgotten what it is, but I know it's very low. I know it's tolerable. So it's 1 angstrom an hour, which is probably fine. For something like Grow-L, anyway. Over 24 hours. And most of our runs are 24 hours. Gabe tends to run for 48, 72, but most of our users, we run, you know, under 24 hours, but something of that order. So 24 angstroms in a run doesn't seem like a deal breaker. Can somebody, well, Pickways is now, what, 300 kilodalton. I mean, Grow-L, you know, see, it works great for Grow-L, something with high symmetry. We've used it for endless icosahedral viruses. Oh, Gabe is chuckling because he used it for some horrible, miserable particle that we all hated in the end because it wouldn't stain right. You know, it was a tiny little thing. What was that, Gabe?
90 KD,
but we did that in stain, actually. For ice, I can't remember what the smallness is. Probably, you know, 400K, something like that. No. I don't think there's any reason why this would be limited more than anybody else would be limited, you know, other than the skill of the person doing the processing. Any other questions?